So where the Genius Act deals with stablecoins, the Clarity Act tries to, and we discussed this on our call a few months ago, tries to delineate jurisdictional responsibility over cryptos. In particular, now I'm referring to the uncollateralized cryptos, so the Bitcoins and the so forth. And the delineation that it drew most prominently was between the CFTC and whether cryptos are a commodity, and the SEC and whether cryptos were a security. But it also indirectly intimated towards the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, as to whether cryptos are currencies. So Genius Act settled the stablecoin issue and the collateralized cryptos and the rules there, and that's gone into law.
Welcome to Against Consensus, a weekly podcast in collaboration with FinNews. I'm your host, Angelo Calvello, and in each 30-minute episode, I interview asset owners, asset managers, service providers, and innovators who are challenging conventional thinking to create better investment outcomes for their beneficiaries and clients. Our goal is to elevate the conversation and help you make smarter investment decisions, always with a little edginess along the way. 8 months ago, my guest today, Gerald Alon Chen Young, CIO at NPPFA, sat down with me right at the start of the push to bring private markets into 401k plans. Back then, the executive order was only 3 weeks old. We're still discussing safe harbor. There was no DOL guidance. It was really just a question of whether this should happen. Well, today it's happening. The DOL has its proposed rule out. BlackRock is rolling out target date funds with private equity and private credit baked in. Apollo, Goldman, Franklin Templeton, and others, they're all lining up for this opportunity. And the PE firms are buying the very advisory businesses that recommend their own products to retirees. So Gerald's back, and we're picking up exactly where we left off. We're going to talk about disclosure, risk, who actually bears it when something goes wrong. Gerald calls it the paradox of democratization. And by the end of the conversation, you'll know exactly what he means. Gerald, welcome back to the show and welcome to Against Consensus.
Angelo, it's such an honor and a privilege being back with you and with your audience.
You're too kind. I appreciate that. That's why I have you back. So you always make me look good. Thanks. That ain't easy either. All right. I'm going to give you a few warm-up questions to get us going. Okay?
Okay. Sure.
All right. Beach or mountains?
Mountains.
Okay. Read a book or watch a film?
50-50.
I'll take it. One long vacation or several short trips?
I would say one long one.
Okay. And given how much you travel, window seat or aisle?
Doesn't matter.
Okay. Done. As long as it's not the middle seat. Am I right?
As long as it's not the middle, exactly.
All right, man. Let me set the table before we jump in. A lot has happened in the 9 months since we last sat down and talked about this topic. When we recorded the first episode, the executive order, I'm going to try to get it right, the democratization or democratizing access to alternative assets for 401k investors, man, it was just 3 weeks old. The 180-day comment period, it just started. Safe harbor didn't exist. DOL guidance had not yet been written. The conversation then was about whether this should happen. Today, the conversation is about what's happening now, right? I mean, we've seen this transformation. The regulatory framework that you talked about has essentially arrived, although only partly. The DOL issued its proposed rule on March 30. It established a process-based safe harbor for fiduciaries offering alternative assets in DC plans. The comment period closed yesterday, June 1st. So we know when we're recording this. And, you know, there was a great article in P&I by Megan Hofferman that talked about the 20,000 public comments that were submitted to the DOL. The timing for us couldn't be better. The key is the market hasn't been waiting around. BlackRock, you know, they've announced target date funds with PE and private credit allocations from 5 to 20%. Empower has lined up an impressive roster of partners, whether it's Apollo, Franklin Templeton, Goldman Sachs, Partners Group, and they're going to be bringing these investments to the 401k market. And here's something we did not talk about in our first episode. PE firms have started acquiring advisory businesses that recommend private equity and other alts. So, Gerald, when we talked, you delineated five risks: capital loss, illiquidity, no backstop, valuation complexity, and fees. These have not gone away. The safe harbor that, from my perspective, and I'm not trained in law, but that's never stopped me before, the safe harbor really addresses fiduciary process, not participant outcomes. And your central concern, if I remember, disclosure remains to me unresolved. So with this background, let me ask you some specific questions. You called, and this is your language, you called for onerous disclosure as a primary safeguard. Does the DOL's proposed rule deliver that, or does it primarily protect sponsors from litigation while leaving the participants exposed?
It's a little bit of both. But regarding your preamble, I read that article from P&I. I saw the over 20,000 comments, and the legislations that you summarized, I think, take us exactly to the question that you've just posed. By the way, for reference, the legislation in chronological order are the passage of the Genius Act and the Clarity Act in what was called the Crypto Week in July of 2025 last year. Then there was the passage of the Non-CBDC Act, so Non-Central Bank Digital Currency Act. Then in December, there was a passage of the Investor Act of 2025. So that's four pieces of legislation out of Congress. And then I have a subset called Other. And under Other, and again, you alluded to three, all, in fact, you alluded to all three of them. One is the executive order that was issued in August of 2025, or executive orders, plural, I should say. The second is the SEC guidelines that allow the relaxation of rules and restrictions regarding closed-end funds buying into private equity. And then the last point you raised concerned the DOL, the Department of Labor, and its creation of safe harbors, which in a roundabout way essentially allowed the same. It's opening the door for otherwise closed-end listed funds, and unlisted for that matter, to buy privates. So that's the sort of legislative chronology of what you alluded to. Now, those five pieces of legislation, four legislations and three other, those seven bits of information, let's just say legislative and regulatory devices, have led to the question that you rightly ask. Namely, is the matter of disclosure, onerous disclosure, going to be sufficient for retail investors to wade into this pond called privates? And I think that's an excellent question. It's one we addressed when we spoke last. But I think that question is a little narrow in light of what's developed over the past 6 to 7 months. A broader question is onerous disclosure plus certain means tests, for example, ownership of liquid assets outside of the ownership of a house, salary, income to the household. So that combination of means testing plus knowledge testing, onerousness of disclosure, are those two safeguards sufficient for raising the standard of what constitutes an accredited investor? Remember, with the passage of the 1933 and 34 acts, right, the Securities Exchange Act and the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934, there were standards set that could be summarized as being, quote, only accredited investors are permitted to invest in this class of illiquid assets. Really boiled down to what was called accredited investor on the one hand for individuals, and QIBs, qualified institutional buyers, for non-individuals. So the notion of onerousness of disclosure and the right sort of means testing, whether it's net income, whether it's investable assets, et cetera, those two standards, the question that arises and the broader question is that sufficient for elevating the standard of what constitutes an accredited investor? That's what I think this entire debate hinges on. And the reason I think it hinges on that is because ultimately, Angelo, as you of all people well know, better than most, as they would say about Tiger Woods, for example, better than most, what's at issue here is the incidence of risk, the risk of the illiquidity, the risk of the non-guarantee of positive IRRs, the risk of the non-guarantee of positive multiples, right? Multiples on invested capital, the risk of being caught in a cash flow dilemma whereby capital calls are being issued, but there are no guaranteed capital distributions. And lastly, the risk of no recourse or bailout from Uncle Sam. I think those are the kind of risks, the kinds of risk that the elevation of the accredited investor standard will ameliorate. And the incidence of risk is who bears it. DBs, for example, have been allowed to buy private equity forever, right? Defined benefit plans. Why? Because the onus with a DB is on the employer or the plan sponsor. However, moving from a DB platform to DC, as most pensions have in this country and gradually around the world are, as we move from DBs to DCs, who is bearing the incidence of the risk? It's the employee in a 401k. It's the retiree. You've transferred effectively the risk-taking onus from the employer slash plan sponsor to the employee slash retiree. They're the ones that bear the risk if the investment fails. If the investment fails in a DB, it's still the employer that's on the hook. They have to indemnify. In a DC, the indemnification comes, well, there's no indemnification. It just falls on the 401k owner. So it boils down to risk incidence and who bears it.
Okay, so my question originally was on disclosure.
Okay.
And, you know, we talked about accredited investor, means test. I get that, but I don't think that's part of I guess we looked at four pieces of legislation and one regulatory. I mean, I don't see anything that talks about accreditation in there. If you're a 401k participant, you may have these options available to you, right?
All right. So you brought up the Department of Labor. And the specific language under the DOL is certain safe harbors. That's a specific language in their guidance. And the safe harbors are to protect against the so-called six factors that were outlined in that P&I piece that you referenced. They reference six factors: performance, fees, liquidity. Come on, Gerald, don't fail me. Valuation and valuation methodologies. That's four.
Complexity.
Benchmarks and complexity. Six, right.
Mm-hmm.
So what the DOL language did was provide safe harbors against those six risk factors, which is a fancy way of simply saying the employee bears the risk or the retiree bears the risk.
Right. I mean, and that's what I mentioned in my preamble about how the safe harbor addresses fiduciary process, not participant outcomes at the end of the day, right?
Now, regarding disclosure, onerous disclosure, what I meant when we spoke, what was it, last 4 or 5 months ago, whatever it was, and what
Eight
I mean
months.
Today is yeah. still applies.
Mm-hmm.
If I were in the position of being a fiduciary and I am democratizing access to alternative investments, specifically privates, I would make sure in my company, through the compliance department, they would have a signature line beside every single paragraph or an initial line. When you're refinancing a mortgage or you're doing anything involved, there are certain lines you have to initial. All that means is you're indicating you understand what that sentence means or you understand what that paragraph means. I would have that throughout the entire document, sentence by sentence if necessary, certainly paragraph by paragraph, meaning I want a written attestation that the retiree or and/or employee understands what that sentence and paragraph means.
I like that. I'm not sure that's going to happen. I haven't seen anybody talk about that. But again, your research is deeper than and broader than mine, I would say. But I get it. So, I mean, your point is you're still in favor of onerous disclosure and letting people know the embedded risks in these private investments, right?
And the reason is you don't want N number of years from now when there is a blow up, and invariably there will be a blow up. The problem with private markets is you just don't see the blow-ups. When the Dow Jones or the S&P or the NASDAQ falls 3 or 4% in one day, let alone 7% or 10 or 20 as it did in 1920s or in 1987, when that happens, it's an immediate shock. You go home, you turn on the television, and the news is the Dow fell 13 or 15% or 10%. Most people in this day and age, in fact, I have a neighbor that does this, will physically check on their iPhone. They'll check on their account how much money they made or lost in dollar terms that particular day. God bless his soul. But anyway, in private markets, the immediacy of effect just isn't there. You won't see the marks. The marks don't show up instantaneously. And even if we use official marks, so based on quarterly lags, by then the effect has been muted.
I mentioned that You know, we're seeing PE firms now buying RIAs and advisory firms that are in a position to recommend these private market investments into 401k plans. You know, the firms are basically selling product that their advisors are buying. It seems like a structural conflict, a conflict of interest. This wasn't there the first time we talked. I mean, is this a conflict of interest that's just hiding in plain sight?
You know, when I read that second question of yours, yep. my first thought was there was a reason why in 1933, there was a passage of the Glass-Steagall Act. It happened after the crash. And forgive me if I have the dates slightly foggily off. Could be 33, 34, whatever it was. The point is, after the banking crash, there were pieces of legislation that came out. And one of the most notable ones was the Glass-Steagall Act that put a firewall between commercial and investment banking. So when I read your second question, see, and by the way, it's in the public knowledge, public realm that PE firms are buying these advisory firms, RIAs and so on. My first thought was, wait a minute. So they're buying them without firewalls? Where's the language of separation of duties and so on? That was my first thought. All of a sudden, the private equity firm now owns an advisory firm that is advising and recommending private equity. I know that sounds circular, but that is in effect what it means or could mean.
Right.
So if we're opening the floodgates to allow that type of, it's salacious to say, but in near incestuous type behavior, and forgive me for being salacious, there needs to be accompanying regs, not dissimilar to the Glass-Steagall Act.
Yeah, but Glass-Steagall's gone. We got rid of that.
Yep, in the late 1990s, I do remember.
Right. I think that was in the Clinton administration, if I remember.
Yep.
So we don't have that separation. So, I mean, we do have this conflict of interest and no protection. I doubt we'll see any kind of regulatory constraint put on these firms, given how far and how fast they've moved, and also the current administration. In my view, I mean, they're very friendly to this act because they're the ones that proposed it. So,
I hear two separate questions there.
Go ahead.
Yes. there hasn't been any grumbling. I haven't heard any grumblings of the need for accompanying regs to ensure that there are sufficient firewalls. I haven't heard any either. But there hasn't been a crash yet.
Yeah.
There hasn't been an incident which causes regulators to recognize that there is an inherent conflict, as you said, an inherent contradiction in having a firm, an entity called X, that sells illiquid private vehicles, owning an advisory firm called Y that recommends investing in X. I know that but that is in effect what your question is.
Yeah.
And then the other matter regarding administrations and the disposition of administrations, you know, and I'll make a little digression here. I spoke at a CFA event in Pittsburgh a few weeks ago with some really and truly brilliant minds, including the brilliant CIO of PNC. But the reason I brought up her name and her brilliance is because someone in the audience, if I recall correctly, posed a question regarding defense of these PE levels, price equity by PE multiples. And I thought her answer was superb. And I actually commended her on stage. This administration has created, and again, there's no judgment call here. These are matters of fact. They have created conditions that have allowed the E in that quotient, PE, to grow, meaning favorable tax policies, defensive tariffs, opening markets, removal of regs, onerous regs in particular. In fact, not just onerous, removal of regs outright, and so on. They've put in place a set of mechanisms that, in a way, defends the growth of E. And if E is growing faster than P, then you can defend these atmospheric levels or stratospheric levels of PEs. That's a long-winded way of saying, under the right administration or the right sets of administrations, they can put in place things that can promote certain investment vehicles and options. Now, whether that turns out to be prudent or not is another matter. But I'm just saying that it is possible for different administrations to create circumstances under which certain asset classes are favored more than others.
But that takes us naturally to my third point. when we spoke, and I think it was 8 months ago, because time flies, you warned very specifically that the government was becoming the ultimate backstop if this democratization goes wrong. Have you seen anything in the regulatory framework that reduces the government's backstop risk? Because what you're just saying here would be great if the government took a role, but are they?
No, I haven't seen anything, but I wouldn't expect to. The question you've posed is inextricably linked to the notion of moral hazard. If you create circumstances under which, and in this case, retail investors are flooding into privates, and there is a crash in private markets, seen or unseen, okay, then if there's a sufficient number of retail investors, and here I'm referring now to the class of pensioners, retirees, if that number is sufficient, it is almost guaranteed, and I hate to use that term, but it is almost, I think assured is a better term, because guaranteed sounds like a contractual financial obligation, but there will be a moral obligation, or could be a moral obligation, again, if the numbers are sufficient. There are 350 million people in our great country. If a third of them, 100 something million, are in these PE things, wisely or unwisely, and there is a crash such that the entire retirement cohort in the country is now threatened, it is my view, and it is only my view, it's just my professional view, that the government will intervene. I know that it's not a parallel argument to bank failures, but you could make a parallel argument. You could, especially in the early days of banking.
Yeah, you could. You could also make a kind of an argument for potential civil unrest. I mean, if this were to happen.
If a third of the country is in riot and they have children and grandchildren, it's trickle-down economics. I don't mean to sound crass.
Yeah.
If the grandma and grandpa are suffering because they're being issued capital calls with no positive IRRs or positive multiples and no distributions, all of a sudden they're funding their capital calls, which are contractually bound, or they're contractually bound to fund, they're funding that out of their Social Security payments. So they file a complaint, and that feeds down the familial food chain. The children feel it, the grandchildren feel it, all of a sudden, again. So that question of governmental backstop is inextricably linked to moral hazard. And part of the moral hazard is this democratization. Baker McKenzie, the great law firm, put together a piece, as did the Harvard Law Journal for, it's called the Law School Journal on Compliance, or something to that effect. And they both covered this. They referred to the paradox of this democratization of access to privates. The Baker McKenzie piece by one of the senior partners there, I've forgotten his name or her name, and certainly the Harvard Law School Forum on Corporate Governance or something to that effect. Both of them use the language, quote, the paradox of democratization of access to privates.
But did they talk about moral hazard?
I don't remember whether either used those exact words, but between the text, there were those references. You see, they went on to say that the reason that it becomes a paradox is because by opening this market and allowing retail access on the one hand, and on the other, having this onerous disclosure, having these means tests, having these knowledge tests and so on, in a way, you're going to force the private equity firms and private equity markets to behave a little bit like public markets in terms of the regs that they'll have to check off in their due diligence, disclosure requirements. So it becomes paradoxical in a way. And also, the nature of private equity is such that there's an element of so-called LIFO versus FIFO in inventory parlance. Last in, first out, or first in, first out. You start opening this to private investors, then, and I do distinctly remember, I can't remember whether it was the Harvard article or the Baker McKenzie article, there will be an element of offloading of assets.
How so? What do you mean by, what do they mean by that, an offloading? You mean you're going to see the PE firms start selling?
Selling some of their less favored assets. They will use this forum, this new pool of liquidity, to offload otherwise not so well-performing assets.
Right.
And again, the reason I lump this under the moniker of moral hazard is because it doesn't have to be intentional.
Mm-hmm.
It is the nature of the beast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I've seen comments from some journalists in this space talking about, or actually there was an academic that I think I came across that really talked about how the plan participants, you know, they're not getting the cream of the crop here. That's going to the DB plans, the sovereigns, the endowments, the foundations. And you may find that, like I mentioned, with BlackRock putting 5 to 20%, may not be the best tranche at the end of the day.
I'll make two quick comments on that. Two quick but very important comments. We mentioned that having retail investors, the idea of democratizing access, the idea in principle is honorable and noble. There's nothing bad per se about democratizing access. Okay, I just want to state that for the record. I'm not calling it a bad thing. But there are inherent pitfalls that maybe haven't been sufficiently addressed. So the first point I'd like to make regarding that comment is retail investors, the majority of retail investors, have never heard of J-curves, gates, lockups, side pockets, etc. They don't even heard of them. So all of a sudden, they've committed through contract to a private equity entity. And the private equity entity, and by the way, you and I have both seen this as institutional investors, we commit to a firm and they don't make any investments for the first year. Yet every quarter, they're issuing their capital call for fees. This, as you know, is the basis for J-curves, right?
You
payment of fees before you start putting capital to work. Just imagine, again, a household of retirees living off of a fixed income as what the French would call rentiers, right? Rent, they're living off of rent. But they have to fund capital calls out of their cash flow, their retirement income. So there are these arcane little nuances that are not fully considered, to use some polite language. Mm-hmm. The other remark I'll make on this point is, again, and this has nothing to do with any bad intent or malintent. It's just the nature of the beast. You get in these vehicles and you're ill-equipped. The cost to society, if you think in terms of private versus social marginal costs and benefits, I'm not sure whether the social, if you try and equalize marginal public and private costs and benefits, I'm not sure that that equilibrium exists.
Everything you're saying is taking me back to your original five risks: capital loss, illiquidity, no backstop, valuation complexity, and fees. And then, of course, you mentioned the six, now benchmarking. We keep coming back to this. And, you know, I appreciate you stating that in principle, you don't have a beef with this, but it's in practice and making sure that the participants, not the sponsor, is able to benefit from their participation in this democratization process. And I mean, I keep coming back to the disclosure. And it's, you know, I'll ask you, if the disclosure is not, again, onerous, it seems like it puts the sponsor in a bind, depending on the final definition of safe harbor. It puts them in a bind. And I think that's one of the reasons we haven't seen sponsors jump on the bandwagon and start loading up their 401k plans with these, I mean, in many cases, they're hybrid target date funds, right? I mean, is what they're trying to put together here. They're not jumping on the bandwagon yet. To me, I think it's a disclosure. It's the safe harbor. And we've got this one lawsuit that's with the Supreme Court going back to Intel. If you remember the Intel lawsuit, when they had the permissibility of alternative assets in a DC plan, I think a lot of sponsors are waiting for that to be sorted out. And I don't have an opinion on that. But, you know, the Intel lawsuit is going to be, I think, a clarion call for these sponsors to decide yay or nay. But hey, you're the one that went to law school. I just did a PhD in philosophy. So what do I know?
I know you chose better. So we've discussed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So we've discussed 7 pieces of legislation / regs / guidance, right? Mm-hmm. The 4 pieces of legislation are the Genius Act, Clarity Act, both in July of last year, the non-CBDC Act, which I don't remember, I think it was just after that in the autumn, and then the Investor Act of 2025, which I believe was in December. Of those four pieces of legislation, only one has become enacted, meaning gone through the House and the Senate and the signature. Only one, the Genius Act. The Genius Act, as you know, set forth the rules regarding stable coins and essentially fully collateralized crypto, right? And how banks can't issue those and offer interest-bearing accounts based on those crypto creatures. And even the powerful and brilliant CEO of JP Morgan just yesterday or the day before once used language, and I'm quoting here, so-and-so is full of blank. When he was saying that on the one hand, if you allow these entities, I'm speaking just entities in the context of the Genius Act, so stable coins and other fully collateralized cryptos, if you allow those to use the metaphor again, wade into the pond of banks, the rules and regs are asymmetric, as Mr. Diamond pointed out, right? Banks have to set aside reserve capital. Banks have to provide for anti-laundering. They're rules that banks have to adhere to that these new entities wouldn't. And in that context, Mr. Diamond said to those that are proposing these as an alternative to banks, in other words, a DeFi world, a decentralized finance world, in contrast to traditional finance world, he referred to one of the principles, I can't remember who he was referring to, as being, quote, and I'm quoting here, full of blank. So of those four pieces of legislation, Genius, Clarity, Anti-CBDC and Investor Act. Only one has come into law, Genius Act. The other four, if I'm not mistaken, are stalled somewhere between the House committees and the Senate. So there's something to be said about that pause that we see happening within the Congress.
Does that give you hope? Does it give you hope, that pause?
It has to give me something. I don't have anything else to go on. Drowning person clutches at a proverbial straw, right?
Yeah.
I think the prevailing wisdom that I believe is coming out of certain Senate quarters is, wait a minute, you know, just hold on a second. So where the Genius Act deals with stablecoins, the Clarity Act tries to, and we discussed this on our call a few months ago, tries to delineate jurisdictional responsibility over cryptos. In particular, now I'm referring to the uncollateralized cryptos. So the Bitcoins and so forth. And the delineation that it drew most prominently was between the CFTC and whether cryptos were a commodity, and the SEC and whether cryptos were a security. But it also indirectly intimated towards the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, as to whether cryptos are currencies. So Genius Act settled the stablecoin issue and the collateralized cryptos and the rules there, and that's gone into law. That's come into law. Clarity Act, not yet. Anti-CBDC, not yet. Investor Act, which is the real biggie here, this is the real gorilla that this entire conversation is focused on, is the loosening of rules and standards and permissible investments of closed-end funds into private vehicles. I think now, if I'm not mistaken, the cap is 15% that a closed-end fund can buy into privates. They're looking to remove that limit. It's the Investor Act of 2025 that's the real gorilla that we need to pay attention to. The other three pieces of regs, legislation / guidelines, come out of A, the executive order, which obviously is untouchable. That's an executive order. That's from the president. B, the SEC guideline changes and rules. And see the Department of Labor tweaks, including offering safe harbors. If you take that entire seven entities, Genius, Clarity, Anti-CBDC, Investor Act, Executive Order, SEC Guideline Tweaks, Department of Labor, Safe Harbors, you take all seven together, the amalgamation is cryptos are here to stay. I think that's one inference and conclusion we can draw. In some form, they're here to stay. But they should not be investable for all investors, meaning certain asset classes, whether it's cryptos or privates, should not be for everyone. Now, I'm not one to determine who that should be or what the standard is, but I believe, and I still maintain, that one way to get at a correct standard is through, to you overuse the term that I know you find so funny, onerous disclosure.
I mean, it goes back to suitability, is what you're talking
about, and sensibility.
About, right?
I would say suitability and sensibility.
Let me ask this, Joe, in closing, where do you think we go from here? Put on your Merlin hat and, you know, give me a forecast, because you may be back in 8 months and I want to have something about what you're thinking. I mean, you pointed to the regulatory and the governmental process that's in place. And maybe there will be some hesitation and people will take a deep breath. But I mean, what do you think is going to happen in this? Are we just going to go ahead because you have such strong organizations on one side of this trade pushing forward? I mean, these firms are making capital commitments now, buying firms, partnering with firms. They must have some expectation because they're not doing that to try to get into the DB side of our business. So what's going to happen?
And you want to put a real wrench in those spokes?
Go ahead.
Add AI to all of this discussion.
Oh, okay.
Add AI to all of this discussion. Where do I think we're going? A few places. One, the world of DeFi is not going anywhere. It's here to stay. Meaning cryptos. And cryptos in all incarnations and iterations are here to stay. Some will be collateralized, some won't. Right? The notion of blockchain and global ledgers that instantly clear debits and credits, which, by the way, is an old notion that goes back to ancient Egypt. In ancient Egypt, there was the concept of agiro. Now, I'm not referring to agiro that you eat, which is spelled with a Y. In the context of ancient Egypt, it was agiro, and I'm not sure if it's pronounced gyro in the since it has an I, but it's G-I-R-O, referred to an automated system of clearing debits and credits. This goes back to ancient Egypt. And that could have been, in some weird multi-generational way, the original blockchain. But again, it goes back to ancient Egypt. So this is pharaonic Egypt, literally. So DeFi is not going anywhere, and cryptos in all their various forms are not going anywhere. That's one. Okay. So that's one thing.
Okay.
Second thing that's not going anywhere, the regs. We're going to go through so many iterations back and forth over what these regs are. What is the appropriate set of regs? For example, I'm going to single out the third piece of legislation that I cited, the Anti-CBDC Act. Angelo, in my humble but best professional judgment, that will not last or remain not overturned. And for me, the litmus test to that particular piece of legislation will be one of the G7 countries. Okay, so as it stands now, we can't issue a CBDC, right? We cannot, right? It's not yet fully law, but that's the direction that we're heading in, right? It's passed in the House. If it passes in the Senate and it goes to the president, he will sign, it'll become into law. So let's assume, arguendo, that we can't have a CBDC. What do you think will happen if one of our G7 partners issues one? Pick a country, even if it's not a G7. One of the Scandinavians, right? Okay. The Nordics.
Let's take a progressive country. What happened?
A progressive country. Let's take one. Let's take Switzerland.
Okay.
They're always forward-thinking, conservative, but forward-thinking. Their view to remain independent and outside of the euro was part luck, but part prescience. They wanted to remain an oasis of neutrality, and they did. Just imagine what will happen if the government in Switzerland, or again, any of the Nordics, issue a CBDC, their own version of a central bank digital currency. If one G7 entity does, or a related entity does, there will be, in my view, again, in my best but humble professional judgment, there will be a domino effect. If one does it, another will be at least tempted to, and I believe eventually will. And if two do it, the rest are all going, the dominoes will all fall. What do I see happening? DeFi not going anywhere, including cryptos and all its incarnations. Two, CBDCs are coming. Central bank digital currencies are coming.
Okay.
They will eventually come. There will be a digital version of the dollar. I'm not saying it will replace the dollar, nor will it be replace the euro, but there will be digital versions in the future. And I have actually published on a platform like LinkedIn a view modestly suggesting that that will happen within the next 18 months or so. Now, I could be handed my head on a plate if I'm wrong, but I did go out on a limb a few weeks ago to write, I can't remember which piece it was, saying that I envisage one GC or related entity to issue their version of a central bank digital currency. The third thing I see happening is growing acceptance. As you know, I serve on multiple boards, including a few based in Chicago. And when we go to board meetings, we normally, not all the time, but normally stay at the O'Hare Hyatt.
Yep.
O'Hare Hyatt Regency or something to that effect, whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. It's a Hyatt Regency near the O'Hare Airport.
I know it. It's got the four big towers, right?
Oh, right. Okay. I remember being in astonishment attending a board meeting some months ago, could have been more about a year ago, whenever it was, noticing two placards, two signs posted in the lobby. One at the reception desk and the other at the lobby bar. Do you know what the signs read, the placards read?
No.
No cash accepted. And my knee-jerk reaction was, wow, this has to be the clearest sign that cryptos are going to become grown in acceptance in retail establishments. Okay, Hyatt Regency is a giant establishment, but it's still retail. Just imagine if you start seeing those signs at McDonald's or Wendy's.
DoorDash.
Or DoorDash. Yep. Take your pick.
DoorDash is already there. Yeah, yeah.
DoorDash is there. I mean, I have a DoorDash account, but it's linked to either Apple Pay or my Amex. But you're right. I mean, I've never paid cash on any of those delivery services. So those three things are what I see happening. The fact that DeFi is here to stay through the whole prism of cryptos, both collateralized and uncollateralized, that CBDCs are coming. And I know that's slightly controversial, but my view is the test for that will be when some other GC, G7, issues one. And the third thing I see in terms of the future is the ever-growing acceptance in the retail world of non-cash payment.
Well, Joe, that's a great place for us to end here. I mean, you've given me another tour de force. I appreciate it. It's basically a tutorial you give me. And Angelo, I'm doing my best to suck it all in.
I would not go down that rat hole. I learn from you more than you know more than you've forgotten more than I'll ever know. And I don't suffer from any delusion over that. I don't suffer from delusion.
Well, that's kind of you. And it's kind of you to come back on the show, pick up the thread. And I mean, I will say you were right about your comments were spot on before about those problems of capital loss, illiquidity, no backstop, valuation complexity, and fees. Now, maybe we'll get together in a few months and see if you're right on DeFi's here to stay, central bank, digital currency, and no cash taking over.
I look forward to it, Andrew.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to subscribe to the show on the podcast app of your choice and follow us on the Against Consensus YouTube channel. You can also find episodes at the Against Consensus website, and the show's episodes will be on FinNews' website. Also, it'd be great if you could follow us on LinkedIn. All the links are in the show notes. If you have someone who belongs in this conversation, an asset owner, an asset manager, a service provider, send them my way. If you represent an organization that wants to reach the most sophisticated audience in institutional investing, then let's talk about a sponsorship. And if you're an emerging manager with a genuinely differentiated investment approach, let's talk about creating a custom episode for you that can help you build your brand. And in case you're wondering, our music is provided by the Super Trio, courtesy of the Northrop family. No AI-generated music for us. Thank you for your support, and we'll see you next time. Namaste.
All opinions expressed by hosts and guests are solely their own. The information presented in this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only. The host, guests, and their affiliated organizations are not providing investment, legal, tax, or financial advice. Investment strategies discussed may not be suitable for all investors, as individual circumstances may vary.
This episode is brought to you by Castos Productions.